Math. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 till 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4, and don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackanddrea.com. Welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today, we are talking about COVID, about the COVID-19 pandemic, and this really ugly, frightening spike in cases that is occurring not only here in Wisconsin, but all across the country, and indeed, all over the world. And we're going to look at COVID through the eyes of two members of my own family. In part one, we're going to be speaking with my sister, Dr. Rondi Berg, who is a family practitioner who lives in Decorah, Iowa, and at least most of her medical practice is in a very small town in southern Minnesota, Harmony, Minnesota. And we're going to find out what it is like for her to contend with this current situation and trying to keep herself, her family, and her patients as safe as possible from the scourge of COVID and other issues as well. In part two, her daughter, my niece, Aiden Spencerberg, who now lives in Paris, France, is going to tell us what it's like to live through the COVID pandemic in Paris and what's going on there. So I look forward to this this following program very, very much for a couple of different reasons. And Rondi Berg, Dr. Rondi Berg, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've talked several times before, although I think the last couple of times it has not been about anything related to your work as a family practitioner, as a medical doctor. Let's just start with a summary so people understand the kind of doctor that you are and the nature of your particular practice, because I have a feeling it's a little bit out of the ordinary, a little bit uncommon. Explain exactly where and in sort of what way you are practicing medicine.
Yeah, so I actually do outpatient medicine primarily. That means that I don't admit people to the hospital. I rely on colleagues in La Crosse and also in Rochester and Decorah to admit people who need to go into the hospital. So I see people in two different clinics. One is in Harmony, as you said. The other is in Spring Grove, so I split my time between those two clinics. In addition to that, I'm also currently acting medical director at three different nursing homes, which right now adds a whole different layer of worry and complexity to my work. So those are the ways that I spend my time, outpatient medicine in a clinic, usually with full schedules, and then also balancing the work of helping to care for nursing home residents.
Right. As all of this first began, I mean, when we here in the United States first began really to be directly impacted by COVID back in the spring, how difficult was it for you and your colleagues and counterparts in terms of trying to contend with this with probably a somewhat limited understanding of COVID-19 and with some of the scarcity of certain resources that we in the general public heard so much about.
Yes, so you may be referring to the shortage of PPE or personal protective equipment that was really kind of the scourge of our existence early on in the pandemic and is still an issue, but fortunately seems to be less of a problem currently. But in those early days, yes, that was one of the things that we dealt with on a daily basis. And you might recall that initially community members were advised not to acquire PPE for their own use, reserving that for the medical field. And we now know that, you know, everyone is encouraged to wear whatever forms of PPE, usually meaning homemade fabric masks or masks that they acquire through other means. That's a part of what we recommend as just a daily routine. So, yeah, that was a big part of the early days. Very definitely the amount of knowledge that existed around this virus was far smaller than it is currently. And we had weekly updates through our headquarters in La Crosse, where we were absolutely glued and hanging on every word, you know, taking in every little bit of information that that was known or becoming known.
Right.
I would say one of the biggest differences that I've noticed from the earlier days of the pandemic compared to now has been a shift in the attitude of patients who come into the office. So that early on in late March and April, if I were to ask someone, do you have any questions about COVID? Do you, you know, have any questions about how to protect yourself or your family? It was not at all uncommon. It happened several times a day that the person would just immediately blow up. And would go on and on about, you know, oh, this is all a hoax, this is, you know, not real, and I don't want to hear anything about it. And, you know, you just kind of quietly move on. But I will say that now, over the past couple or even few months, that has greatly shifted, so that now whenever I ask someone, you know, do you have any questions about how to protect yourself or your family or the symptoms to look for with COVID, they're very receptive to the question. Usually the answer is, I hear about it all day, every day, and I know everything I feel like I need to know. But a big shift just in attitude and response to that question.
Wow. So just to be clear, what you're talking about is when you would be talking about a patient where there is no direct connection to COVID. I mean, it's not somebody who thinks they have COVID or you're wondering if they have COVID. It's just kind of a general question about well-being and staying safe. And that early on, you had a lot of patients not particularly interested and or not very receptive to even the notion of hearing about COVID, and that has changed a lot. And
yes.
I should think you are happy about that. My wife, Kathy, has a very good friend who I don't remember now exactly what she does. I want to say a nurse practitioner, but I don't think that's correct, actually, but somebody who works in a hospital here in the area. And at a couple of different points, and particularly early on in the pandemic, she was talking a lot about shifting protocols.
Yeah.
At certain times, she's worked, for instance, in the ER, and protocols would change. I mean, from this date to maybe 2 weeks later, the protocols would have completely changed because of new information. Can you just kind of give us a sense of just how drastically this shift in information and changing in protocols has happened over this period? And has any of that settled down? I mean, are we in a period now where we are in a little more sort of solid state of understanding COVID and how it is spread and how to deal with it? Or
right.
or is this still as much an evolving situation as it was a few months ago?
Right. So I can't necessarily know the specific protocols that she's talking about.
Of course.
But as one example of the type of protocol that initially was shifting by the day sometimes, is that we would have a tiered system, and still do to some degree, a tiered system of how to prioritize who can get tested, how quickly that result comes back, and so on. And earlier in the pandemic, there were definitely people who, you know, in a lot of ways were very deserving of being tested, but who simply didn't fall into one of the tiers that would allow them to be tested. And just to give an example of that, I had a call from someone who had a brand new grandchild who had been born several states away and wanted to visit, but the new mom was insistent on having a negative COVID test prior to their arrival, which, you know, is a very reasonable request. But there was no place in that tiered system where there was an allowance for that. And it was absolutely heartbreaking, you know, to have to say, I'm sorry, but we don't have a way of offering you that test. And now that testing has become more widely available, it certainly is considerably easier to get tested, certainly if you have symptoms. But even if you don't, if you've had an exposure and are wondering if you might be one of those ubiquitous asymptomatic infected people, there seems to be much better access to testing.
We're speaking in this portion of the morning show with Dr. Rondi Berg, my sister. She lives in Decorah, rural Decorah, Iowa. She practices medicine actually in southern Minnesota, in Spring Grove and Harmony. And her practice also includes overseeing three different small nursing homes. And I'd like to talk for a moment about that. And of course, everybody listening understands that we are talking about an especially vulnerable sector of the population when it comes to COVID. And I remember getting a text from you at one point in one of many discussions we've had about COVID where you said something to the effect that, well, you know, and when COVID, you know, enters one of our nursing homes, and it wasn't if, but when, it just sort of floored me and saddened me to think of working in a situation where something really scary also felt all but inevitable. I believe these three nursing homes have been spared any really serious widespread outbreaks, although correct me if I'm wrong, but give us some sense of what it is like to be working with patients in these kind of settings and what can be done to keep these patients as safe as possible.
Yes. Yeah. One little brief correction. I might be unique in doing this, but I always refer to people who live in nursing homes as residents as opposed to patients. And that's simply because the nursing home is their home, and that's where they reside. Hmm. Kind of in recognition of that fact, that we really are entering their home when we go into their room or otherwise interact with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a challenge to keep the nursing home population safe, and there are a number of I don't know what you'd call them, maybe firewalls in place to try and help keep the pandemic out. And that ranges everywhere from screening workers as they come in, certainly screening with temperature checks and screening for symptoms and so on, but also through what we call point prevalence testing, and that's where everyone who works for the facility and the residents periodically are tested just to make sure that we're catching anyone who might be asymptomatic and yet carrying the virus. Keeping residents largely in their rooms, minimizing or sometimes stopping altogether, people from the outside coming in, and that might be something as simple as the person who does their hair. There are times when that can't be allowed. Certainly, everyone is well aware of grave restrictions on visiting in person, which has also been so difficult for everybody. It's a particular challenge when you have nursing home residents who may have an element of dementia, and that can make it very difficult for them to understand or appreciate the importance of staying within their room or not wandering into a neighboring residence area. They sometimes have very little understanding of why they need to wear a mask or how to do that properly. It's complex, to say the least. And I do count myself fortunate not to have had to deal with any of the large outbreaks that so many nursing homes have faced. But that's not to say that we've been spared altogether.
One of the interesting shifts through this pandemic, it seems to me, is that there is a little bit of turning away from certain things that we were really fearful of in the early going, particularly an obsession with or preoccupation with the cleaning of surfaces for out of fear of picking up the pandemic in that way, picking up the virus in that way, I should say. And and now there seems to be increasing understanding that that really this is caught in the, transmitted in the air, through the air, and it is the air we breathe that we need to be most mindful of, and so on. Is that a fair summation? And I wonder to what extent that shift in understanding has changed the way you are, first of all, practicing medicine and keeping your residents safe, and even when it comes to your own home and your own family and yourself, in terms of keeping yourself safe from COVID-19.
Right. So what you're referring to is something called fomite transmission, where the virus might stick to surfaces or particulate matter or what have you, and then be picked up by touching that surface. And that is thought to be less of a player in transmitting COVID, thankfully. I wouldn't say that it's really changed how we conduct things in the office. Regardless, we are still going to, wipe things down after every visit. We're still going to be, washing our hands faithfully and frequently throughout the day, and liberal use of hand sanitizer and so on. So I really can't say that that has changed, and nor do I see it changing in the foreseeable future.
Right.
It has made some difference, though, I'd say, in our home and in the way that we are around each other in this home space. There was a time early on when just someone sitting on a couch and putting their hand up, onto the armrest of the couch, and I'd make a mental note about, okay, better, wipe that down or what have you. And really it just was something that you could about drive yourself out of your mind with.
When you visited recently, you actually shared a term with me that I had not heard before, but it's apparently a term that is used by some in the medical field, and it is called hygiene theater. And it is a phenomenon in which people become needlessly obsessive with some of these kind of practices that we've just been talking about. And not that they have no worth whatsoever, but it is possible for them to, in a sense, distract us from what matters the most. Do you see a lot of hygiene theater? I mean, you want to explain that term?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that that is happening in the medical setting, in the sense that it's necessary sanitizing that's happening. It really is a term that's referred more, to other situations. So, someone who goes to fill up with gas and they first wipe down, with a Clorox bleach wipe, the entire apparatus for dispensing gas, and then fill up their tank, and then wipe down the touchpad before entering their PIN number and what have you. That really just doing what you need to do, grabbing the gas nozzle thing and filling up with gas, and then afterwards doing one thorough, sanitizing of your hands, that would be, likely be sufficient. But it's maybe a little bit of a more exaggerated example, but that's what I mean by hygiene theater. And the danger of it is not so much a matter of overkill, but rather the directing of resources into activities that may be somewhat futile, that money and supplies and so on could be directed into more high-risk situations.
Right. Well, then, of course, it also could be a potential distraction from what matters most, which is keeping your distance and being masked.
Yes.
And are we pretty firmly set scientifically that the wearing of masks really and truly does make a difference?
Well, so I'm only one voice, and there may be other voices that would speak differently. I would say that, yes, there is no doubt that it helps. The degree to which it helps could be argued. I wear a mask faithfully. I get out of my car and the mask is immediately on, even if there isn't anyone around me, and I go about doing whatever errand I'm needing to do or what have you, and that mask is on my face the entire time and doesn't come off until I'm back in the car. I would say, though, that the things that make the most difference are avoiding gatherings in the first place. If you do gather, to do it outside whenever possible. And if that's not possible, to make the indoors as much like the outdoors as you possibly can, with good ventilation and so on, to keep gatherings as brief as possible. And then the whole idea of distancing. So, the other day we needed to gather for a particular purpose, and we did it with this other couple outside, and we were a good 10 to 12 feet apart, and everybody wore masks, and we were outside the entire time. And we had a really enjoyable time. So, some of it is about learning how to enjoy each other's company in new and creative ways. I think this Thanksgiving, for example, we're planning on doing an outdoor bonfire and probably do that at Christmas too and sing carols around the fire. And we just have to figure out new ways. And those new ways can be beautiful and enjoyable. They will just be different.
Right. Very well said. Dr. Rondi Berg, my sister, I am so happy to have you back on the morning show. Thank you for all that you have shared today and Thank you for your good work on behalf of all of your residents and patients. Take care. Stay safe.
Thank you. You too.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We, of course, are tremendously concerned about the COVID-19 numbers that we are seeing here in Wisconsin and indeed across the country. The much feared, much talked about fall surge is very much, of course, upon us. One thing that has, in some respects, been lost in all of this is how the rest of the world is contending with COVID. And it's in marked contrast to the earliest days of the pandemic when it had not yet, at least in any significant measure, reached our shores. And we were following events in various places like Italy and Spain that were very, very hard hit. And as COVID has descended on the United States, and now recently as it has sort of tightened its grip, it just occurred to me that we have largely forgotten the rest of the world and how the rest of the world is also feeling the sting of COVID-19. So to give us something of a international perspective, if you will, I'm actually turning to my niece, Aiden Spencer Berg, who now lives in Paris, France. And Paris, France is actually at the moment under something of a lockdown. In fact, if one looks up just what is going on and goes to the Convention and Visitors Bureau of Paris, it says right at the top of their website, as of Thursday, October 29th, 2020, Paris, like the whole of France, is once again confined. And so we're going to find out from my niece, Aiden Spencer-Berg, about what it means for Paris and indeed all of France to be confined because of COVID. And I think in hearing about this, it will give us something of a better perspective in terms of what we are dealing with in terms of our own restrictions on our daily lives here in the United States. Aiden Spencer-Berg, my niece, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It is such a delight to be here with you.
And just interesting to be able to look at my screen and see you as though you're across the street instead of across the ocean. So before we talk about kind of the situation with COVID and Paris and France, explain briefly to our listeners why you are living in Paris, France at the moment. What has taken you to this really beautiful and exciting city?
So I have been living mostly in France for the past year and a half or so, because my wife is French and all of her family is in France. And previously we had been living in the south of France, right outside of Cannes. But we recently moved to Paris this fall because she hasn't enrolled in a musical theater school called the Cours Florent. And her classes started up this fall, and we moved here for that.
Hmm. So when you planned to move to Paris, and actually when you actually did make the move, Paris was still relatively open, although I'm sure with certain restrictions in place, or certainly with concerns about COVID very much in the air. And then things changed. As to the best of your recollection, explain when and how and in what way the situation began to change in France and specifically in Paris.
So I arrived in Paris on October 22nd. I had spent about a month back in Iowa visiting friends and family. So I had only been in Paris for about a week before confinement started. But honestly, it doesn't feel that different, which is a bit scary. There are certainly a lot of restrictions in place and lots of businesses have closed down. But when I go out to get groceries or something like that, it seems like there are just as many people in the street as before. And yes, people are still wearing masks, which they were doing previously. But this lockdown, at least at this point, hasn't been nearly as restrictive as the first confinement. And so compared to the week leading up to the confinement, it hasn't been that different.
So at the moment, Paris is in something of kind of a middle ground, it sounds like, where they have not yet cracked down to the full extent that they potentially could. So let's talk first about what this current state of confinement in Paris means. And I want you to explain, first of all, the matter of wearing masks and to what extent they are required in Paris and what happens if one chooses not to wear them.
Yes, so masks are required anytime you are outside in the streets and when you enter a building. And if you are seen not wearing a mask, you can get a fine. And in theory, that's something that helps keep things safer and ensures that people are wearing masks, but it's not something that I've witnessed being enforced, really. For the most part, people are still wearing masks, but the threat of a fine doesn't seem to push the entire population into wearing a mask or wearing a mask properly all the time. The fine is, in theory, 135 euros, which is a pretty hefty sum.
What would that be in American money?
I would think maybe like $160.
Wow. So in the United States, as you well know, Aidan, there are lots and lots of people who dutifully wear masks, as we have been so instructed. But there are some people who really resent being told to wear masks, and certainly a few people who very much choose not to wear them or wear them only when they absolutely have to, and in many cases, often for kind of political reasons, feeling like it is just more intrusion on our private lives from the government than is warranted. I mean, that is the feeling or opinion of some. In a place like Paris, France, are you aware of any of those kind of political dynamics going on when it comes to the matter of wearing masks, or not so much? Is that more of an American phenomenon?
Being connected to people who are both in the US and France, this is probably one of the biggest differences that I've noticed in COVID attitudes, is that in the US, we really do have those extreme opinions where some people are being hyper-vigilant about wearing masks and social distancing and all sorts of COVID protocols, and others who are, you know, protesting it all aggressively. And in France, I think it's much more of a middle ground. In general, people are wearing masks all the time, and there's not an anti-mask movement, but there's a lot of complaining about it and a lot of people wearing masks improperly, and it's not a, you don't see as much of the same positive energy around COVID protocols, I think, as you have the potential to see in the US.
One thing that I noticed on the website, again, for the Paris Convention and Visitors Bureau, which kind of spells out some of the specifics about the situation in Paris, they talk about mask wearing being compulsory and for everybody 6 years old and older. And it also says in that same section, public and private gatherings are prohibited. Is it clear to you what those words mean, and also to what extent that prohibition is being followed?
I think that for me, what I've understood is that indoor gatherings in particular and large outdoor gatherings have been stopped. I am also, because I don't work anywhere in person in Paris, I'm not allowed to travel, I think, more than a kilometer from my residence for any reason besides maybe groceries or medical, or maybe it's 5 kilometers. And so in that sense, my social life is very restricted, and that, you know, really limits me to my one area. But there are still a lot of people out in the streets, and the few times that I've taken the metro, that's still very crowded, which is, I'm sure, one place that has a pretty high contamination rate, and that feels a little scarily normal to be in. So I'm not really sure how much that's being reinforced. And one of the weirdest things, or the trickiest things between this confinement versus the first one we had in March, is that because it's in more of a middle ground, there are a lot more gray areas about what's allowed or not.
So in other words, the confinement that you just referred to back in March, when the pandemic first struck, that confinement was even more strict than what you are under at the moment. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it was more strict. And I was living in a different city at that time, but nationwide schools were closed. K-12 schools were closed for the most part, and that's not happening now, which would be probably one of the major differences between the two confinements. And there's also a big debate about what's an essential business right now. And in the first confinement, that was much stricter and really just limited to, you know, hospitals and where you get your food and, you know, what we think of as being the bare necessities. And right now, it's in much more of a gray area, and places like car dealerships are considered to be an essential business. Mm. But bookstores are not, and there's a big debate about that right now. And so, yeah, it's a little more unclear than before.
My recollection from that first period of confinement was that for you, you had to have some kind of a pass, written pass, in order to venture outside of your home or in any particular distance. Can you remind me how that worked?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that I have to fill out again now too. The permission slips have kind of gone back into place. And it's something that you fill out on your own, and you just find online, and they ask for kind of your basic information, but also the city that you were born in. And you have to check a box for what your purpose is for going out. And there are only, you know, certain activities that are permitted. And if you are just going out for pleasure, for a walk, it can only be for an hour.
One thing I noticed, Aidan, on the website for the Paris Convention and Visitors Bureau is a little section which says, which is labeled closed places. And it is at a glance, it doesn't look like a long list, but then you look more closely at the kind of things that are closed, and you realize that it is really kind of devastating in terms of the cultural life there. Museums and monuments are closed. Theaters are closed. Bars and restaurants are closed. Cinemas are closed. Shopping centers and department stores are closed. Pools and gyms are closed. When you look at a list like that, what is it like to be in a city like Paris when all of those kind of places are not open to the public anymore?
Yeah, I mean, it feels very weird, particularly since Paris is such a cultural hub for France and Europe and the world even. And basically what's happened is that anything that's fun or community related is closed. So I think it has kind of a cold atmosphere right now. Some of the things that I was looking forward to the most about living in Paris was, you know, all of the things on the list that you just said. And I have a lot of musician friends in the area who I've been excited to reconnect with, and that's just going to have to wait. Which is really too bad, but you do what you got to do.
Right. I was looking at the list right below that of open places, and fortunately, parks and gardens remain open, supermarkets, grocery stores, bakeries, pharmacies, police stations, you already mentioned, schools, places of worship, but without ceremony, we are told. And one thing that struck me as really kind of intriguing is that the places of sale and computer repair remain open. And it's kind of interesting to think about a world in which that is regarded as an essential business. And I don't mean to phrase that in a way where it sounds like I'm doubting that. I think it just says something about the centrality of those kind of things in our lives, that would be one example of a business that is remaining open during this period of confinement. Are you finding things open that are supposed to be open?
I would say yes. And it was interesting to hear you mention that computer stores are still open. And I wonder if that's also because so many people are being encouraged to telecommute, that those devices are even more important and central to our work as well. For me, for the most part, you know, if there's something that I really need, I'm able to find it and things are open. Marie recently tried to track down a book, and that was an interesting thing to try to do since bookstores are closed. And some places are doing something called click and connect, where you can go and do a pickup from a location. But because they're not an essential business, bookstores have been pushing the government to close all book sections in other supermarket stores. Because since supermarkets are open, they can still kind of fill in those roles, and it kind of gives them an unfair edge in that area. So right now, if you go into a supermarket, the book section is closed off as if it wasn't there. And I think that's true for clothes too.
Interesting.
Since clothing stores are also closed.
Wow. So when you venture into a grocery store, I assume in Europe that you experienced something of what we experienced in the early days of the pandemic, in which there were sometimes bare shelves in the grocery store. I mean, around certain items that were being purchased in unprecedented amounts. And actually, we have not seen much at all of that in recent months. I'm just curious, in Paris right now, when you go to the grocery store, by and large, does everything appear to be available to you? Are the shelves full?
Right now, the shelves are all full. And I think that that's in part because in my experience, French people don't have as much of a hoarding mentality as we do in the U.S. From what I'm remembering in the U.S., some of the shortage was also just, you know, people preparing for an apocalypse and just, you know, stocking up way more than was actually practical to have, even for, you know, a 2-week confinement if everyone in their household got sick. And I think that French people aren't hoarding in that same way that we do in the U.S. In grocery stores in the first confinement, I think that shelves were more bare. And I think that's also a sign that in general, people took the virus more seriously earlier on in the crisis, and that now people are just kind of tired of it. And so aren't preparing in maybe the same way that they were back in March.
Interesting. So I overheard you as we began this Zoom call, as you were talking to my wife, Kathy. I overheard but didn't really hear the specifics, but some of the most recent numbers in terms of COVID cases, either in France or in Paris. What can you tell us about the situation there at the moment? I mean, how serious is this surge?
Yeah, the numbers are looking pretty scary right now. Before I called you, Marie and I were both looking up the stats. And today we have had 86,000 new cases. And France has also just gone over the 40,000 death mark as well. So it's if you go on Google and look at the cases graph over the course of the year, we are in an enormous spike right now. From what I'm remembering of the numbers back in March, I think like 10 times worse than our previous peak.
Wow.
Which is pretty scary.
Right. So it sounds like you anticipate that sometime soon, maybe by the time this interview airs, there is some expectation or at least reason to assume that the level of confinement may become at its highest. Can you explain what that would look like if indeed the confinement would become even more strict?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all if there was a big change in what's happening, you know, even in the next couple of days. One of the things that they're thinking about introducing is a cocooning policy, similar to what Ireland did this summer, which would be having all people over the age of 70 and people who are more vulnerable really not go anywhere, even for groceries, and really stay in a very true confined situation. I imagine that a lot more businesses will close too. Schools will probably go online or take a break, and universities too. Right now, universities are kind of half open, or certain courses are allowed to continue while others are not. So yeah, I think all of that's going to get a lot stricter.
So how do you end up spending your days and spending your nights in a place like Paris, with so many of kind of the normal things not open, not accessible? How is Aiden Spencer-Berg living in Paris these days?
Right. So I do my best to still get outside every day. I have an hour of, kind of quote unquote free time on the permission slip where I can go out and just have a walk around and stretch my legs. So I try to do that to get out of my building a bit. The job that I have right now started online. And so for me, my work life hasn't changed that much. But my social life is contained to the apartment right now. But I still try and get up in the morning, and past couple days have started it with doing dishes and just keeping everything tidy, and trying to practice my French more. And I have my guitar and my ukulele here to make sure I'm still doing some music, even if I can't meet up with the people who I had initially hoped that I would be playing with right now. And lots of reading and knitting and just kind of enjoying some nice indoor activity.
All good things, all good things. By the way, what can you tell us, at least in general, in terms of the overall situation in Europe? I strongly suspect, but I mean, let me preface the question by saying I think one of the things that's really regrettable is how much we Americans have become completely absorbed in just how our own country is contending with COVID, and not particularly mindful of the rest of the world, although maybe in France, French people aren't thinking a whole lot about people outside their own borders either. I mean, it's understandable to an extent to be mostly concerned about where you are and the people and places you know and care about. All that being said, overall in Europe, is this similar sort of serious surge being experienced, and is life changing for a whole lot of people across the continent?
So from what I read earlier today, France is the country in Europe with the highest total number of cases since the beginning of the pandemic. I'm not sure how France's numbers compare to other countries right now, but in general, I think France has been hit pretty hard, and maybe the hardest in certain aspects. And honestly, that's mostly what I know compared to the rest of Europe right now. And I think it's true that, right now, mostly I'm aware of what's going on in France and also the US, since, of course, I'm connected to that country and have many people there that I love. But yeah, I think it's very true that everyone's kind of narrowing in on what's happening in their area, since the stakes are getting higher.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I really appreciate this opportunity to have you share with our listeners your perspective as an American in Paris, as the phrase goes, and to hear about what you have been experiencing there, you and, let's say, your fellow Parisians, as COVID-19 continues to tighten its grip. And of course, we all hope that better days will soon be upon us, and in the meantime, that people hearing this will continue to take every possible precaution to keep themselves safe and those they love. Aiden Spencer-Berg, my niece from far off Paris, France, I appreciate you joining me today for the morning show today. It was great to talk to you. Take care and stay safe.
Thank you, Greg. It's been such a joy to be here with you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Nan Calvert and the Rails to Trails Conservancy Group, which facilitates the conversion of abandoned railways